From the National Urban League, this is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Clint Odom, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Toni Wiley, Director of Advocacy for the National Urban League.
Well, welcome to 2020, Toni. I wasn't sure we were going to make it.
You weren't?
2019 was a little rough. I know I needed a little bit of respite, which I got, thankfully. Mm-hmm. I hope you were able to get some, too.
I was, and I want to also wish you a happy new year and a happy new year to everyone in the movement. I think that 2020 is going to be a very interesting year, a very good year personally. I celebrated a birthday on January 6th, and for those who know me, I'm a big birthday person. And I recall there were a lot of other people celebrating, not necessarily my birthday, but they were celebrating 12th Night and King's Day or Day of the Epiphany. And I know you being from Louisiana, those are things all very familiar to you.
You know it. You know it. I was right there with you.
Oh, were you? Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was a blast. Do you have any resolutions or any goals that you have for 2020, Clint?
I'm still working on mine. You know, I procrastinate a little bit, so I'm still working that out.
So December, you'll have them already?
Maybe before then, okay. But I'm resolved to develop my resolutions.
That's smart.
Yeah.
I'm not typically a resolution person, but I have recommitted myself to lead a more balanced life this year and to eliminate self-limiting ideas and behaviors and to be more present in every aspect of my life.
I'm not really sure what that means, but it sounds like a pretty good resolution.
I think I heard Oprah say it, so I think it's good. I'm going to stick with it.
If she didn't say it, you should actually suggest that to her. That sounds like a pretty good goal for the year.
So, Clint, when we ended 2019, I really thought that we would come back to the movement in 2020 and talk about the impeachment, because that was all the buzz before we left for the holidays. So what has happened since then?
I will give you 4 letters to put it all in context. I-R-A-N, Iran. Iran has bumped impeachment off the headlines of the newspapers and the websites that we read, and it's all about the possibility of war in Iran. And we thought perhaps with the fact that most of us don't know where Iran is on the map, maybe we know it's out there in the Middle East someplace. Maybe we even know that, didn't we have some beef with them back in the late 70s, early 80s with some hostages or something? You know, what is it about Iran? And so, you know, we thought maybe it was important to help unpack what's going on in Iran and explain it to folks in the Urban League movement, because as we talked about in our first podcast dealing with foreign affairs and national security, what goes on in other parts of the world has direct bearing on what we're doing here in the United States. And I also, you know, have been thinking a lot about Dr. King's life in this time of his holiday, in the time that we celebrate his holiday. And I know that Dr. King and the words that he spoke during his lifetime have been prophetic, especially on the issue of war. Not many people appreciate the fact that Dr. King, during his lifetime, was a highly controversial and very unpopular figure in a lot of quarters. And one of the reasons for that was because he took a very hard stance against the war in Vietnam. Not a popular thing to do in the 1960s, in the late 1960s in particular.
I think Dr. King really envisioned America being a beloved community where we all work together in harmony and peace, and that people were treated equally and respectfully, not only here in the U.S., but around the world.
I went and picked up a book to remember, more specifically, one of the anti-war quotes that most resonated with me as a father to 4 children. And it was Dr. King talking about children and violence. And so I've got the book here. "I've told the kids in the ghettos that violence won't solve their problems. But when they ask me, and rightly so, why does the government use massive doses of violence to bring about the change it wants in the world? After this, I knew I could no longer speak against violence in the ghettos without speaking against the violence of my government." Those words could be spoken today and would be highly relevant today. But that's what I remember about Dr. King and his views on war and violence.
I think Dr. King really had a very deep understanding of the importance of peace to social justice. We can't solve domestic problems when we have chaos everywhere else in the world. One of the quotes that I reflect upon related to his stance on war is a speech that he gave called A Christmas Sermon on Peace. He gave that speech in 1967, just a few months before his untimely assassination in 1968. And he said, "One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal we seek, but that it is a means by which we arrive at that goal. Destructive means cannot bring about constructive end."
Wow. Again, right on the nose as to what we're going through right now. So why don't we bring out our guest, Dr. Brett Rosenberg, to help us understand what's going on in Iran, what's the historical background in our relationship with Iran, and what are the prospects for security going forward now that we are in a heightened state of military aggression with Iran?
Hopefully it ends in peace.
For our second show on national security and foreign affairs, we are very pleased to have with us today Dr. Brett Rosenberg. Brett is an associate director of policy at the National Security Action Firm. Previously, she was a legislative aide to Senator Kamala Harris, where we got a chance to meet and work together. And I can tell you, folks, Brett is quite brilliant, and we're very lucky to have her today.
I paid him earlier.
Brett received her bachelor's from Harvard and her PhD from the University of Oxford, where, of course, I went to school as well.
Yeah, me too. got a dictionary, too.
And like the both of us, she was also a Rhodes Scholar. In all seriousness, we really appreciate you coming out to talk to the Urban League movement about national security, which is an issue that we often overlook, but is so important. And especially on the occasion of the Dr. King holiday, many people forget that Dr. King was an anti-war activist and was particularly focused on the war in Vietnam. We thought it'd be good to bring back and do our second show on national security. So, Brett, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brett, Clint has told us so much about you already, but what else would you like to add? What else would you like to tell us about your background and your interest in foreign affairs and policy?
Oh, man. Well, as Clint said, my background is mostly being a nerd, going from school to school to more school. And as part of that, I studied history. I've always loved stories, and history is really all about stories. You know, a lot of people think of it as just sort of the list of facts and events that happened, but really, history is about the interpretation of the past and the narratives that we put on it. The stories we tell and who writes those stories is about power. And so I just found it absolutely fascinating. And in learning about American history, I realized that a lot of the questions that I was asking, whether it's about the New Deal or the evolution of the civil rights movement, couldn't be answered by just looking within America's own borders. You had to look at America's relationship with the rest of the world. For example, take how the civil rights leaders used the fact that the U.S. was in the middle of the Cold War to pressure our own government to make much-needed changes. So basically, I love thinking about how the domestic and the foreign intersect, and I'm really excited to keep working on that.
You know, Brett, I met a lot of young people who study foreign affairs and international relations. You can often find people who do this as a major in college or even a minor, but you see very few people who actually work in the national security field. What would your advice be to a young person out there who's studying international affairs and who's really interested in doing this work? I mean, how do you really get into it as a profession that can pay the bills and give you a long, colorful career in this field?
Well, I think right now there's too much luck involved, actually. The field is, as people say, far too pale, male, and Yale. It's largely based on relationships from elite schools coming through very similar institutions. And this is a huge problem. So part of what I would say to folks is sort of at a base level, try and build out your networks, try and work through this, but also make sure that when you do make it, bring other people up with you. We need to be expanding the circle of people who are thinking about, talking about, and making our foreign policy to make sure that the people making our decisions are representative of America.
So we've talked about the fact that you're a history buff, and we talked about your educational background and the firm that you worked at. I mean, my goodness, we took a look at the bios of the people that are there. Of course, if you're a cable TV fan, you see Ben Rhodes and Jake Sullivan, the principals at your organization. But, you know, Susan Rice and Samantha Power, and it's a veritable who's who in foreign affairs and national security. What's your day job like, and what are you doing on a day-to-day basis at the firm?
Yeah, it's a pretty awesome group of people that have come together to try and push back against what the Trump administration is doing in our foreign policy and national security. And I get to think about what we might do next. With all of these challenges that we're facing today, if there's a Democrat in the White House going forward, there's probably going to be the temptation to just sort of put things back the way that they were. And I get to sit in this great imaginative space where we are bringing a lot of people together to think through what could be, what would a truly progressive foreign policy look like.
So you're being very preemptive.
We're trying to be prepared, you know, just in case.
You talked about forward-looking, but I want to take a moment to kind of go back a little bit. We brought you here to really talk about and help us understand the conflict that the U.S. is now in with Iran. What can you tell us about the historical context of this relationship that we might need to know before we delve into what's going on right now?
Yeah, this is a really tumultuous relationship, full of periods of conflict and then of diplomacy and of more conflict. And I'm going to do a serious injustice to this history by focusing on sort of four main spots. So first is 1953. And so that year, the U.S. and the British backed a coup overthrowing the democratically elected leader of Iran. He had made moves to nationalize the oil industry in Iran, and we were not having that. And so we helped support a coup and put in place a leader called the Shah. The Shah was an authoritarian ruler, but we backed him regardless because this was the Cold War and he was seen as a staunch ally against communism.
So, Brett, when you say nationalize the industry, the leader wanted to nationalize the oil industry. Can you tell our listeners exactly what does it mean when a nation threatens to nationalize an industry?
Well, it means that there were private companies there before that were making a lot of money, especially British companies in this case, and that Iran wanted to take it over and make it a public entity of Iran, which would have cost a lot of money to the folks who had been stakeholders in the previous companies. So let's move on to point number two. And so we'll fast forward to the moment that probably stands out most in American foreign policymakers' minds today, which is 1979. And this is the year of the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. So that year is when the Shah is overthrown. He actually flees to the U.S., which will become a problem for the U.S. in the hostage crisis. And the Islamic Republic of Iran is established. Later that year, a group of hardline students storm the American embassy in Tehran and take 52 Americans hostage, demanding that America return the Shah to Iran to stand trial. The hostage standoff actually lasted for 444 days, and it has sort of been indelibly placed in the mind of the American public and policymakers.
That number 52 is a number that I've heard recently.
Yeah, President Trump actually threatened 52 sites in his response to any form of Iranian retaliation for the Soleimani strike.
Referencing,
probably not.
Okay.
Yeah. In thinking about our grave historical injustice of skipping so many things, I'm going to skip all the way ahead to 2015. Because in 2015, Iran agreed to a nuclear deal with the U.S., the U.K., Germany, France, and Russia. This is the Obama deal. And of course, it's not just the Obama deal, right? It's the Obama and five other countries deal. This is a huge feat of diplomacy. And this deal is formally known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is why you might hear it referred to as the JCPOA. So this came about because there was a longstanding concern about Iran pursuing a nuclear weapon. So when President Obama came into office, he faced a choice, which was that Iran was on the way to developing this devastating piece of warfare. And so we could try and prevent them from doing so through war, or we could try and prevent them from doing so through diplomacy. And Obama took what is arguably the harder route and chose diplomacy. This involved massive coordination of international efforts to first bring Iran to the negotiating table and then to come to a deal. The deal itself is based actually on a pretty simple bargain. In exchange for the U.S. and this group of partners providing economic relief to Iran, Iran agrees to never build a nuclear weapon. That's the deal. And the agreement went beyond the Iranians' word. It actually includes the most stringent verification and monitoring regime ever, which allows international inspectors to come in and prove that Iran is actually abiding by the deal. This bargain worked. Iran agreed to it. All those six countries agreed to it. And even the Trump administration actually admitted that the deal was working, that Iran was not pursuing a nuclear weapon after it signed on. it's a pretty amazing example of a group of countries coming together to make peaceful change and something that we should see as a model, which sadly then brings me to my fourth key moment that we need to think about, which is May 2018, when Trump pulls the U.S. out of the JCPOA. So as a candidate, he had campaigned against the deal, calling it, as you just said, Tony, the Obama deal. And he made a political calculation that his base would be energized by him trash-talking anything that his predecessor had done. And as president, he followed through and pulled the U.S. out. He's violated the deal by placing sanctions back on Iran to put economic pressure on them. And he's calling this the maximum pressure strategy. And this approach has really led to where we are today. We need to remember that the JCPOA was working. Again, his own administration admits this. And that since Trump has abandoned it, Iran has taken steps towards restarting parts of its nuclear program. And we've seen this escalation between the two countries.
We've heard instances of other countries like North Korea is developing a bomb or may in fact have one. What's so perilous or dangerous about another country in the Middle East developing a nuclear program and having a bomb?
Part of this is the fundamental question of, I think, do we want to live in a world that has more nuclear weapons or fewer nuclear weapons? And we are all safer in a world that has fewer nuclear weapons. The more weapons that are out there, the more likelihood that we get into the type of catastrophic war that we cannot recover from. So any country gaining a nuclear weapon is a huge problem. And actually, I would argue that this administration has not done a very good job of preventing North Korea from getting a nuclear weapon either.
Going back to the Middle East, and another country that we've had interactions with in the past as it relates to weapons of mass destruction, one question that I really have, and one thing that I really want to understand more, is where does Iraq fit in all this? Are Iran and Iraq allies? And if so, why would Iran fire missiles in Iraqi space at their air bases? And how do you think military action that the U.S. took against Iran impact our relationship with Iraq? And does that put any of our other allies at risk?
This is a really good question, because if we have a complicated relationship with Iran, like, it's nothing compared to Iraq's. They're neighbors and historical adversaries, but they also have important people-to-people and cultural ties. So part of the reason that Iraq has been featuring so prominently in a lot of these stories is that both the U.S. and Iran are kind of treating Iraq as some sort of pawn in this game of escalation. Essentially, both the U.S. and Iran have been trying to use Iraq to prevent the other side from gaining influence. Iraq is unsurprisingly not pleased at being used like this. So from the U.S. perspective, we currently have troops in Iraq that are working as part of the coalition to defeat ISIS, and we'd like to make sure that they stay there. And they're there at the agreement of the government. Iraq has agreed that they can be there. Iran would like nothing more than to get the U.S. troops out of there so they can increase their regional influence. Of course, we've got to remember that there was little that did more to advance Iranian interests in Iraq than our invading in 2003, which led to chaos and a power vacuum. Since Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, there's been this tit-for-tat escalation between the U.S. and Iran, and a lot of that escalation has taken place in Iraq. Iraq is where an Iranian-backed group killed a U.S. contractor, and it's where the U.S. responded by launching airstrikes against that group in Iraq and Syria, killing dozens. It's also where Trump launched the strike against Soleimani, not in Iran. He did it in Iraq. Because of all this, Iraqis are angry. Hundreds of protesters broke into the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, shouting death to America, which highly disturbed the U.S., given the aforementioned hostage crisis and the Benghazi attacks. Nobody wants to see our embassies getting attacked. And additionally, after the Soleimani strike, the Iraqi parliament actually voted to kick U.S. troops out of the country and force them to leave this campaign against ISIS. It's unclear whether that will actually happen, because the decision actually lies with the prime minister, not with the parliament. But we will definitely have to make some adjustments. You know, right now, just like we saw in the early Cold War that I was talking about, during those times, we used Iran as a means to an end in fighting communism and didn't really think about Iran in and of itself. Right now, the Trump administration is seeing Iraq only through the lens of how it can be used against Iran.
We promised our listeners we would give them some historical background that led up to what is now a fairly infamous date of January 3rd. We've even teased out a couple of times the name Qasem Soleimani. Why don't you tell us what happened on January 3rd of this year? The U.S. military struck out at an Iranian military figure. Can you tell us about the circumstances around that military strike and what happened in the immediate aftermath of that strike. This is the day sort of that will live in infamy, January 3rd. Can you set the story for us and talk a little bit about that military strike and who is this character, General Qasem Soleimani?
As I talked about a little bit when we were thinking about Iraq, there's been this very recent cycle of escalation between the Iranian-backed militia firing a rocket and killing an American, then the Americans firing rockets and killing these Iranian-backed folks in Iraq, and then protests in Baghdad. All of this culminates in January 3rd with the decision to kill Soleimani. So I think it's really important to understand who he is. Soleimani is the head of the Quds Force of the IRGC, which is the Intelligence and Special Forces Unit. So he basically ran Iran's military operations in the Middle East, and including through its proxy forces, so ones that aren't directly Iranian forces, like Hezbollah in Lebanon and other groups in Iraq and Syria. Soleimani caused a ton of death and destruction, including of Americans. During the Iraq War, he killed a lot of Americans. And the Obama administration actually personally sanctioned him. This was not a good guy. The question, though, that we need to ask is not whether or not he was a good guy. I actually think there's two questions we should be asking. So first, did killing Soleimani make us any safer? And then second, do we want to be the type of country that kills officials of other countries? My answer to the first question is absolutely not. This did not make us any safer. And to the second is, I don't think we want to be that country.
We've been told, and there's considerable debate now, that this guy presented an imminent threat to United States security. We've heard the same administration officials within the same government saying different things. Some have said he was an imminent threat. Some have said not so imminent. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of threat the Soleimani character posed to the United States and why it was so important now to take him out?
He's been in power for a while, right?
He has been in power for a while, and the Bush and Obama administrations both contemplated maybe taking out Soleimani and realized this would be a terrible idea. The Trump administration has to argue that it's an imminent threat because that's the only way that this is actually legal under U.S. and international law. However, I'm seeing the same confusing information that you are, which does not point to a credible source of imminent threat. The Secretary of Defense, Mike Esper, came out and said straight up that he hadn't seen intelligence that showed an imminent threat against four embassies, as Trump had claimed. Republican Senator Mike Lee came out of the briefing that the administration gave senators and said this was the worst briefing he'd ever seen as a senator. I have not seen, nor does it seem that anybody has seen, credible evidence of an imminent threat.
Going back to the point of who Soleimani was and whether or not he was an imminent threat, it didn't seem that the action that was taken on January 3rd really purged the region of a murderous tyrant based on the news releases that we as Americans saw in the aftermath. We actually saw footage of thousands upon thousands of Iranians lining the streets to pay their respects. And he was treated like a national hero to the Iranian people. My question is, have we emboldened a whole country, a whole nation, to feel that we have destroyed something precious to them? And what are the repercussions of that? Have we started the next generation of people who are not willing to sit at the diplomatic table with the U.S.?
I think we need to start by remembering that Soleimani wasn't universally revered in Iran and had actually quite a mixed reputation. So what we saw of that footage of Iranians out in the streets, it wasn't necessarily that they were all mourning Soleimani, but also that they were standing up against a U.S. attack on an official Iranian official, which is a big deal. The Trump administration should absolutely have anticipated that the Iranian people might not be happy that we'd take out a high-up government official. And so that, I think, should have played into part of the calculation. And now, actually, after protesting the U.S., they're back out protesting their own government for accidentally downing this civilian airliner that killed 176 people, including scores of Iranians, and then lying about it. I have no idea what the domestic situation in Iran will lead to. But what we do know is that we're not safer after killing Soleimani. We got lucky that Iran's retaliation resulted in no casualties, but there is no guarantee that this will be the end of the retaliation. We are now in a cycle of sort of tit-for-tat escalation, so we don't know what will happen next. We need to remember he's threatened our partnership in Iraq, which threatens the fight against ISIS. And Iran just announced that it's going to breach a key part of the JCPOA, which moves it closer to a nuclear weapon, which was just not in the picture when Trump took office.
We did a show about the conflict in northern Syria. In October of last year, the president abruptly withdrew military support from northern Syria and now, less than 3 months later, has authorized airstrikes in Iraq. Both of these actions took place without any consent or consultation with Congress. Is this the new normal where the United States, acting through the commander-in-chief, can take these military actions without even so much as informing Congress until the tweet goes out saying we've just had a military strike against a sovereign nation?
Yes, I do think this is the normal. But while Trump has done the tweet thing as something that's new, the fact that the commander-in-chief would act without sort of a balanced congressional response is not that new. Although, I actually have hope that this is changing, which is really exciting. So the constitutional power to declare war lies with Congress, but there are competing presidential constitutional powers. Congress, frankly, has fallen asleep at the wheel over the past few decades when it comes to pulling the president back from war. What's cool about this moment is that Congress actually seems to be waking up to its duties. So that's what the War Powers Resolution that's in the news is about.
Can you talk a little bit about this resolution? I've read a little bit about it. The House of Representatives took a vote. What exactly was the vote on, and is the Senate going to take a vote at some point as well?
So the law allows Congress to prevent the president from engaging in hostilities without their express authorization. This means they can have a vote as to whether or not the U.S. will allow the president to continue having troops in Iran without Congress saying okay. The exciting thing is that the House passed a bill that said, we will not allow the troops to stay there. And actually, news has come out recently that suggests there are enough Republicans to pass the same bill in the Senate. This is a great rebuke of the president and a sort of exciting move of an anti-war movement, but it's not going to, unfortunately, change that much because the president can still veto it. That's what happened with the Yemen War Powers Resolution earlier. However, we should not get too discouraged because I think we are in the middle of a building powerful political movement that is challenging presidential authority on these issues and really pushing for a pro-peace stance. I'm really encouraged when I look at the difference between 2003, 2008, and now. In 2003, when President Bush said we were going to go to war in Iraq, there was very muted criticism. There's some really staunch criticizers who stood up for what they thought was right and who are our heroes, really. Barbara Lee voted against the authorization for use of military force, and she's actually introduced a bill in the House now that they're going to vote on to withdraw that same bill 17 years later, which is pretty wild that they haven't done that yet. There's not that much Democratic opposition. When we come to 2008, Barack Obama is elected president partially because of his anti-Iraq war stance. But we have to remember that he was also leaned in really hard to being pro-Afghanistan war, saying that we were going to redouble our efforts. This time around, we don't see Democrats doing that kind of thing. They have been very open about saying we need to restore congressional war powers authority, and we should not go to war. It's really exciting to see that message being mainstream and not being seen as a sign of weakness.
To bring it back home, we have a lot of different issues happening here in our own country. We are facing an impeachment. We have elections coming up, and we have all sorts of interference hovering around that. We have natural disasters piling up in our territory of Puerto Rico. We have unemployment, underemployment, some of the worst healthcare we've seen, definitely within the developed world, roaring white nationalism and anti-Semitism, gun violence. And I could just go on and on about all the issues that we all know are going on here in our country. Where does a renewed war on terrorism fall within our dashboard, in our priorities of what's going on the home front? I'm truly having a Tupac moment. Like, we have money for war, but we can't feed the poor. What's going on?
So among all the different things keeping me up at night, many of which you just named, this idea of a renewed war on terror is one of the biggest. First, the sort of security side. From a threat point of view, all evidence indicates that the biggest terrorist threat to the U.S. isn't groups like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but it's domestic white supremacist and extremist groups. A giant global war on terror focused on Iran is just not how we keep Americans safe. Second, think about the costs of the war on terror, which is not over, by the way, but think about the costs of the war on terror in lives, in dollars, and in opportunities wasted. Think about what we could have done with the $6 trillion we have spent on post-9/11 wars, or the 19 years that we've spent, how much time we could have spent on other things if we had focused not on Iraq and Afghanistan, but on education, on childcare, on maternal mortality, on infrastructure. Finally, you know, think about the incredible damage that the war on terror has done to communities of color in the U.S. We still have not undone that damage, and there's no reason to think it wouldn't get far worse today.
That reminds me of something, Brett. You know, we talked about the upcoming holiday commemorating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. Many of us know, of course, that Dr. King was an anti-war activist. Some of the greatest advocacy of his storied life happened at the end of his life in connection with his protest over the Vietnam War. Do you have any reflections on where we are now with the war we have on terror, the endless wars in the Middle East? What would Dr. King think about the times that we're in? And just interested in your reflections on Dr. King's legacy and where we find ourselves today.
As you said, Dr. King was an anti-war activist. He was a radical on this. We have a somewhat sanitized view of him as handshakes and hugs, but he ruined a ton of his relationships and that he had built up over the goodwill in this community over his anti-war stance. He gave vicious speeches saying that America was corrupting its soul by being in Vietnam. He gave a speech the year before his death at the Riverside Church, which is well worth reading. It's called Beyond Vietnam. And it's really worth looking at how he talks about what war does to a country's soul. And he says, I'm paraphrasing, but that if there is an autopsy on America, Vietnam will be part of the diagnosis. So, you know, if Dr. King were here today, I can imagine he would be out in the streets demanding that we do not have war with Iran, but also that we bring troops home from the plenty of other places that they are right now. We have a president who campaigned on bringing troops home from endless engagements. And just from May to October of last year, he sent 14,000 more troops to the Middle East. This has to change. This absolutely has to change. And I think Dr. King would be absolutely one of the most vocal opponents of militarism in our foreign policy.
On that note, I don't think we want to leave this conversation without sending our heartfelt thanks and prayers and commitment to the members of the U.S. military.
Absolutely.
Our diplomats and thousands of U.S. troops and allies who are deployed and put in harm's way during this crisis, as they have been for years deployed.
Absolutely.
So finally, I think you made a great point about Dr. King and where he would be today. Why should all Americans pay more attention to foreign relations, not just during potential threats of war, but as you said about the troops who have been deployed for years on these international stages? Why should we care about that? Why should our community be concerned about what's happening beyond our borders?
One of the things Dr. King brings up in that speech is actually that he's very excited about President Johnson's war on poverty. And then Vietnam comes and he says that there's no resources all of a sudden for taking care of poverty, no time, no attention, because all of a sudden we're talking about Vietnam. And that's the first reason, I would say, is that while we are focused on other things like war, we are not focused on these issues of justice that we so badly need to address. The second point is that foreign policy is an area where the president can act with the greatest degree of freedom, as we're seeing in Iran. So it's absolutely critical that the public stays engaged to hold them accountable. We can't let a president act with impunity, whether it's bringing us to the brink of war or pulling us out of the Paris Climate Agreement. You know, when the president is acting in the name of all Americans, we should make sure that our voices are heard. And then finally, back to the issues of justice, these can't be solved within the U.S. borders alone. So if we're thinking about inequality, we have to take on tax havens and shell corporations that allow wealthy individuals and multinational companies to hide their money rather than putting it back into the public coffers that will allow for funding our schools and our roads. Climate change and environmental justice, even if we get everything right at home, it won't mean anything if we don't get China on board, get India on board. We need the world. White supremacy. There is a global movement of violent white nationalists out there who cannot be contained by our borders alone. The same threat we're facing here is being exported around the world. We cannot take on some of these fundamental questions of justice in our own country if we do not think about foreign policy and foreign affairs. So I'd urge everybody to get involved, get vocal, and talk to me about it. I'm excited.
Thank you for that wonderful segue. How can we talk to you or at least hear what you have to say about issues in Iran or issues of war in our country and foreign policy. How do we stay connected to you? And how do we learn more about the work that you do on a daily basis?
My organization that I work for is called National Security Action. You can follow us on Twitter at NatSecAction. I am very bad at tweeting, but I'm trying to be better about it. And I am at Brett A. Rosenberg. Yes, thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate your words. You brought up a really great point that there are so many other wars that we could be fighting that would benefit Americans here at home, the war on poverty, the war on ignorance and illiteracy. So I thank you for making that statement. And I know Urban Leaguers can really co-sign with that.
And Brett, I just want to thank you. I mean, most people know, and I think I said at the top of the show that we work together in the Senate. I think for people who are watching up and comers in Washington, D.C. and in national security policy circles, we need to keep an eye on Dr. Brett Rosenberg. We need to put our arms around her and support her, because I think she's one of the up-and-coming people in this field, still very young. And when some of these previous generation folks move on to become elder statespeople and great wise men and women, I think it's going to be your turn. And so I'm really excited about seeing what you're going to do in the future, Brett.
Well,
maybe even
in
a new administration.
I am bright red over here and leaving the room. Thank you.
The entire Urban League movement sends our heartfelt thoughts and prayers to our Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis affiliate as they celebrate the life and service of longtime Urban Leaguer and former affiliate CEO, Mr. James H. Buford Sr., during a funeral mass held earlier this month. Mr. Buford, a St. Louis native, served as CEO at the affiliate for nearly 30 years, retiring in 2013. The current Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis president and CEO, Michael McMillan, said of Mr. Buford, "When you look at iconic figures in the community that bridge the young and old, black and white, rich and poor, I can't think of anyone better than Jim that would be more deserving of this tribute." The Urban League National President and CEO, Mr. Mark H. Moriel, was also in attendance and gave remarks at the tribute. Mr. Buford passed away on November 29, 2019, at the age of 75. If you would like to learn more about the longstanding service and community work of the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis, visit their website at ulstl.org or follow them on Twitter at ulstl. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NULPolicy for updates. Be sure to rate us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Kudos to our production team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to For the Movement, presented by the National Urban League.